Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and it's time we begin the TechNet, as we've done 1,548 times before. This is 1,549, the number of the TechNet. The TechNet is a gathering of the curious radio amateurs who want to know a little bit more about how there are 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater type ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is one of those 26 or 27 kinds. I presume the 26 or 27 also includes IRLP and Echolink. If not, maybe there's really 28 or 29 kinds. There's lots of kinds. And so the curious guys want to know how all this hardware really works. And the group that meets here every Sunday night for a few hours tries to teach each other that, what they found out. Amateurs are very good experimenters. Let me drop it. In the old days, a high percentage of the ham radio equipment had to be hand-built. Nowadays, Southeast Asia, particularly in things like Baofeng, can give you a radio that used to be a couple thousand dollars for now a couple of tens of dollars, you know, 30, 40 bucks. You get a lot of radio these days. So we buy an awful lot of stuff when it comes to normal HF, VHF frequencies. You still have almost the same percentage of true exploratory, leading edge type ham radio operators when it comes to the frequencies above 1,000 megacycles. Most of those guys are building their own equipment. The guy on 10 gigs, with rare exception, is not just going out and buying a store-bought piece of equipment. He's got to do quite a bit of kit building, even if he does that. And so you talk to a guy on the 10 gigahertz ham band, and I've talked to quite a number of those in 10 different states, all from my house. Let me drop. You immediately have something in common with that guy. The two of you are on the same amateur radio band, but there's a large number of ways of getting there. What is he using for an antenna? What is he using for a transmission line? What's he using for a transmitter? What's he using for a receiver? What's he using for a low noise amplifier? What's he using for a power amplifier? How does he key the rig? In the case of 10 gigs and a HOMA installation, because any reasonable kind of transmission line is extremely lossy. I mean, the best waveguide you can get, silver-plated, dry nitrogen-filled WR90 waveguide made by Andrew to a mil-spec. It's got about 5 dB per 100 feet of loss. And there are other kinds of transmission line that you could use on 10 gigs that are a lot higher than that. So the average guy on that band, if he wants a station that works well, he's going to put almost all the ham radio equipment behind the dish on top of the tower. And the IF strip that it uses, usually it's a tunable IF system, a transverter they call it, where the frequency you send up to it is 144 megacycles, the sideband or Morse code. So the equipment is sitting behind the dish. You feed 12 or 24 volts to it. You feed it 144 meg signal. You give it the command to go, and it transmits. And when it receives, it reverses that process. It takes the 10.368 gigahertz signal, mixes it with a 10.224 local oscillator, mixes it down to 144 megs. That signal comes back down the ordinary cable into the shack, and you hear the guy. And so it's hard to believe that that particular frequency, for instance, you would think it's only pure line-of-sight communication. Well, not so much. I've talked to a guy 380 miles away, sideband, and it wasn't a
repeater. Time out.
It wasn't a super unusual condition. One of the interesting factors about 10 gigahertz is that if you live within 200 miles of a major body of water, Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, you live within 200 miles, probably get a band open in some portion of every 24-hour day because of the super refraction phenomenon. Moist air down low has a higher dielectric constant than drier air that's higher up in altitude. That phenomenon gives you a downward bending of the microwave signal. And when that microwave signal follows Earth curvature, has that amount of downward bending in some portion of every 24-hour day, it usually does that. The guy 300 miles away from you way beyond your line of sight horizon. He sounds like he's in your backyard. He could be running a... The guy I was talking to was running a 10 watts, and I guess he was giving me a signal about 40 dB above my noise. I was running 200 milliwatts, all solid state, and I was 10 or 15 dB above his noise. We had a nice sideband QSO. Just to give you an example, all kinds of ham radio. Some of the really progressive people that want to study wireless equipment. Let me drop. They're using ham radio to do it. There's quite a few electrical engineering companies, or companies that produce electronic wireless products, that need transmitter designers, receiver designers, and antenna designers. And the schools do a fairly mediocre or less than mediocre job of teaching those subjects in a useful engineering manner. You want somebody who understands radio. Most likely you've got to hire a ham radio operator. That's a guy who has been tinkering with it for 10 years, talking to other people, comparing notes. Once you talk to that guy on a microwave frequency and you start probing his brain, how did he solve the problem of transmitter, receiver, feed line, antenna, method of aiming the antenna, method of getting the antenna above the terrain, above the trees, and so on? How did he solve the problem? And you talk to 15 guys and you find 10 different solutions to the problem. That makes the difference interesting. Gives you a little bit of a rundown of what ham radio can be and why it's so educational. Let me drop. The TechNet has slowly, over the 32 years, started in 1982 in September. Over those 32 years, we've slowly evolved a kind of a menu. And the menu is that we take sign-ins from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. And we do that for the first hour or so, from roughly 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. Then John, KC2WGB, my co-host, he keeps track of the mailbag for the people who don't yet have the ham radio license or the right equipment, so they can talk to us directly. They send him a communication with their question, and sometimes we get some very exciting questions from guys that are just entering the hobby. They give us a real challenge. After the mailbag, the next thing we have is Paul, WS2N, who keeps track of what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. And he'll be giving us space report number 142 tonight to TechNet number 1549. Along the way, we've got Hal, K60PZ, who has a lot of radio experience for a lot of years. Amazing for his very young age that he can do all that. And he gives us the benefit of his knowledge from time to time. So it's time for the check-ins. If you do have a question or a comment, please give me a call. It is quite possibly we're going to hear from, let me think. I think we're going to hear from Vito tonight. Maybe he had a chance to look at that trap mechanism on his Mosley beam. If not, we'll get that from him next week. So give me a call. That is a name right now. K2RIW listening.
2SHO.
Okay.
VH4YY, Joe, yes, from the last week.
Very fine, Joe. Let me go back one now. I think it was Kilo 2 Sierra Hotel Oscar. And I think that was possibly by EchoLink. And do I have your call letters correct, sir? And please tell me your name. K2SHO, question mark. K2RIW, I'll be listening.
RIW, this is KC2SHO, Kilo Charlie 2 Sierra Hotel Oscar. It's John in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, coming in through IRLT.
Very fine, John. Kilo Charlie 2, SHO, New Jersey and IRLP. And okay, Joe, W2RYY. Alrighty, anyone else to sign in because they do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and your name right now. Okay, one more call. Anyone else out there with a question or a comment for the net? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
US2N is here with the space report, and the name is Paul. Good evening, Doug. John.
Very fine, Paul. Paul, will we be hearing space report number 142 tonight? Is that true?
Yes, since I've been keeping record on the tablet, I don't know how many how many nets before that, but yeah, that's a good system to go by, because I can look those back up. You know, it's a little easier than going to Mike ATV's website. So if we have to do it, we can do it. Back you there.
And there's something else I should mention. There's Mike number two and Mike number one. Mike number one is KC2NJI, and he has a website where the last 7 years of TechNets, with one or two exceptions, are all recorded. You go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and there you'll find the recordings for the TechNet. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and they are in 1 year, here we go, 1 hour reels, 4 reels per weekend, so to speak. There are people who can't stay up late enough to listen to the whole TechNet. Usually starts 8 o'clock, usually ends at midnight, where they turn the machine off at my request, because some of these enthusiastic guys would go until the sun rises. Let me drop. So, there, what people do when they can't stay up that late, a few days later in the week, like around Wednesday, tonight's recording will be there on Wednesday at that net. People will download it to their recording device, whatever it is. And so while they're on the commute to work or on their noon hours, they then can listen to the TechNet if they can't keep their eyes open that late. Some of these guys, as I said, on a couple of occasions, we almost went until dawn because nobody turned the machine off. And now, as a way of having a hard cutoff, I insist the machine can turn it off at midnight. The mic number two is the website, which has an awful lot of complimentary information about the TechNet, articles and pictures, whatever. And that's at limarctechnet.com. L-I-M-A-R-C, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club is what that stands for. www.limarctechnet.com. And that's Mike number two's website. And I should be giving him some more articles that I've got. He's got quite a few of them there already. So those two websites, Mike number one and Mike number two, give you additional information. Let's see what John's got to ask us tonight. Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar. And how long have you been on IRLP, John? Because that's something I have very little knowledge about yet. Eric KE2EJ set it up on this machine, but I don't yet know what it is. So tell us whatever you want to and ask whatever you'd like to. Looks like we've only got two check-ins tonight, so we can take our time. KC2SHO, you've got it. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, KC2SHO, thank you. Let's see, I'll adjust the IRLP thing real quick. A question did come up here quite a few weeks ago now about the IRLP, and I touched in on that, trying to give my best explanation of what it is and how it works. I've been using IRLP for a while now. Sorry, I'm a little under the weather, and I haven't really been talking much today. I think my mouth is not cooperating. I've been using it since about October or November. I've been building a few nodes. Built one for myself, which is the one I'm talking on here, and I've built a couple for a few other hams. Check out my QRZ page. You'll see a bit of what they look like. And All-Star is next on my list. I have all the hardware sitting here, but being that it's coming up on my tax appointment, I've pushed all that aside, and I've got papers strewn about all over the desk. But I do, when we get back around, so I do have a question that, it'll be a hard one to pose, but I'll try to do my best when it comes back here. I've been thinking about it for a couple weeks since your discussion about how transmission line length, this wives' tale about using quarter wavelengths or something like that as a feed line to your antenna. I've never followed that rule and never had a problem, but I have a further expansion on that when it comes back. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Very fine, John. I went to QRZ.com, typed in KC2SHO, and I'm looking at some beautiful pictures of your shack. Picture number two shows a number of shelves of equipment. I have a little bit more equipment than that. None of it's on shelves. It's just piled on tables all over the place haphazardly. I mean, Thank goodness there is no picture of my shack. It would turn you off. But transmission lines. Oh boy. Many a guy has measured his standing wave ratio in the shack of a less than ideal antenna. Ideal antenna if you're using 50 ohm coaxial cable, for instance. That ideal antenna would have to represent a pure 50 ohm resistor at your operating frequency with no remaining reactants of any kind. You put that on the end of a good 50 ohm transmission line, the signal goes down the cable once, hits the antenna, none of it reflects, all of it goes somewhere, hopefully all of it into space somewhere, somewhere that you directed it. If the antenna is anything higher or lower in resistance than 50 ohms, and if it's got any amount of capacitor reactants or inductive reactants, in parallel and series, no matter, a certain calculatable percentage of that signal is going to reflect back from the antenna. And so once you know the real impedance of the antenna, there's a set of formulas that'll tell you exactly what amplitude comes back and what phase angle it comes back at. And that signal travels back down the transmission line. One of the things that's very mysterious, and lots of people will fight you on this one, is that the signal going up and the signal coming back down, even though they came from the exact same source, even though they're on the exact same frequency, traveling through the exact same cable, you could, with 99% assurance, assume that the signal traveling up and the signal traveling down do not see each other. They do not react in any way. You could use that as a crazy-sounding assumption, and you'd be amazed how accurate you are. Let me drop. And so you could build yourself a slotted line, particularly on microwave frequencies, where you put a probe into the slotted line, move it along the length of the line, and you'll find at a certain point you've got a peak of voltage. That's where the signal going up and the signal going down are in phase with each other. And that simple non-directional probe of your slotted line picks up both signals and adds them together at the probe. In the real transmission line, you could say that they do not add. They just feed right through each other. You'd be amazed how many transmission media behave in that manner. I mean, a puddle of water is a kind of a transmission line in a way. You drop a puddle in, you drop a pebble into the north side of the puddle, you watch the waves travel to the south. You drop a pebble into the south side of the puddle, you watch the waves travel to the north. You simultaneously drop two pebbles, one on the south side and one on the north side of the pool of water, and you watch those waves fold through each other with no interaction. As long as the waves are small enough that you're getting linear reaction, no white caps. Transmission lines do that. You can also tap your guy wire with your eye against it and watch the pulse travel up the guy wire, hit the tower, reverse in polarity, come back down, and while it's on the way back down, you create another pulse, up, down, left, right, whichever you like, and you watch those two pulses fold through each other with no interaction. Just as long as the deflection is small enough that you're not creating a nonlinear stretch of the guy wire, so to speak. So many transmission media behave that way. So your bird watt meter, your directional power meter, is able to, under the ideal conditions, measure the forward going power and the reverse going power. And with a chart or an equation, you can calculate that into standing wave ratio. Or you can really use a standing wave ratio bridge that you put in the transmission line, which really is a pair of directional couplers. One coupler is measuring, in theory, only the forward-going signal, and the other coupler is measuring the reverse-going signal inside of those two couplers are inside of your standing wave ratio bridge, and then the machine, so to speak, makes a calculation, or you've done a calibration such that you now, off the meter, read standing wave ratio, or off the light-emitting diodes of a digital display. However, if you're standing wave ratio bridge, or if your directional power meter is anything less than ideal, by that I mean if it has a little bit of leakage signal from the reverse mode getting into the forward coupler, or forward signal getting into the reverse coupler, if there's any leakage signals, lack of directivity, now as you change the length transmission line, You're changing the relative phase angle of the forward and reverse coming signal because it got some extra line to go through, so to speak. And now that signal being combined with the leakage will give you an increase or a decrease in apparent standing wave ratio. So under those conditions, because of a less than ideal meter, you change the length of the transmission line, you'll see the standing wave ratio go up or down, and you say, aha, there must be some magic length of transmission line where I can make the standing wave ratio go down and maybe even disappear. Lots and lots of guys believe that. Let me drop. And there's one other way that this can come about. If you're feeding something like a dipole with coax cable, and you're not using a balloning device, where you've got the center conductor going to the right half of the dipole, and the shield of the coax cable going to the left side of the dipole, because the dipole is a symmetrically loaded device, and you think you're only feeding power with the center conductor of your coax cable to the right side, well, the left side of the dipole is the counterpoise to the right side, equal amount of current is flowing in each, and the way it works out, without that balancing device at that location, you will be launching some signal back down the outside of the coax cable because of that interface. Now, because you're launching signal into the outside of the coax cable, the length of the cable becomes part of the resonant circuit of the dipole. You're now radiating signal from both the dipole and the length of the transmission line. And changing the length of the transmission line changes the amount of tuning of the dipole itself. Therefore, the dipole becomes longer or shorter. As you change the length of the transmission line, the dipole electronically is coupled in that manner because of this phony signal on the outside. And then in that case, also, changing the length of the transmission line, because it changes the tuning of the dipole, will change the standing wave ratio. So for at least two of those reasons I've just given you, let me drop. There's a whole bunch. Because of that, those two different experiments that I just described, where a person will have a visitor to the shack and say, look at that. You see the standing wave ratio change when I add this length of coax cable to my transmission line. That's proof positive in his mind, because he's seeing it with his own eyes, that, hey, there are magic lengths of transmission line where the standing wave ratio gets better. It's a matter of interpretation, as you can tell. And boy, lots and lots of discussions have gone along these lines. I probably jumped way off to one side, but you're allowed to ask your full question right now, John. By the way, as I said, the beautiful-looking website you got there at QSZ.com. Nice photography. Looks like a well-arranged shack. KC2SHO in what was the name of that town? It says it right here. Sure enough, Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Sounds like a nice mountainous area. Good place for a ham shack. Over to you, John, K2LIW. Go ahead with your real question.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Well, Dick, it's almost like you were reading my mind. You probably had an inkling of the kind of questions that I have. My son did jump down here and say goodnight to me, so I may have not fully understood when this happens, and it sounded like something about a less than ideal meter. So if you don't mind just maybe quickly hitting just that one point again, I would love to hear that. I'm sorry, I have to apologize. I didn't quite hear it here as my son was coming down. But yeah, that's pretty much the question. You're right on point. My notes here were saying to expand on the discussion about wavelengths of coaxial cable. Point number one, when does length really matter? Of course, putting loss aside, we all understand loss pretty well, I think. We don't need to go back into that. And how about directional couplers? That was a subpart of question one. Part two. How about directional couplers, magic tees, and duplexers? And what about, you know, the position of that directional coupler along the line? If you could magically move that directional coupler along the line to any position without, you know, having to cut and make lengths for every position along the line, how would that affect how the directional coupler works? We do see on the network analyzer that this makes some change in the pattern that is displayed in the return loss, but is that really changing the measurement? And as you told me before, that pattern there is a product of physics. And you had discussed impedance inversion, and I'm not quite sure I understand what that means. So I think that about covers it. K2RIW, KC2SHO, I hope my questions are clear.
I was waiting for the beep. We finally got one. Yes, they are, John. A Smith chart is a beautiful display of any possible impedance on a transmission line or the input or output impedance of a transmitter or receiver or an antenna. So at one fixed frequency, no matter what your antenna, transmission line, amplifier, resistor, whatever, no matter what object you put at the end of a, let's say, 50-ohm transmission line, because you're using a 50-ohm vector network analyzer, your exact impedance is going to be a dot somewhere on that chart. If the dot was in the exact center of the Smith chart display, that would be exactly a 50-ohm resistor. If the dot was at the far left-hand side, that would be a zero-ohm resistor, or a zero-ohm load. And the far right-hand side would be an infinite impedance load, in the usual way people display a Smith chart. Way up high at the 12 o'clock point is an extremely high inductive reactance, and down at the 6 o'clock point is an extremely high capacitive reactance. But your particular dot of your exact impedance of your antenna or of your transmission line on your network analyzer, let me drop. That dot has a certain distance from the center of the chart. The center of the chart is the bullseye, the most desirable place. That's where you've got an exact 50-ohm resistor. And if your dot is anywhere away from that center, you've got some amount of standing wave ratio. If it's all the way over to the left-hand side at the 9 o'clock point, you've got an infinite standing wave ratio. That's a short circuit. And if it's halfway there, maybe you've got a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio. I don't know the exact number, but it's proportional to displacement. Once you locate that dot of your exact impedance, assuming your transmission line is lossless, and you add extra transmission line, your dot will move in such a way as if you had taken a ordinary compass, you put the sharp point in the center of the screen, you put the pencil on your dot, and now you swing the compass in a clockwise manner. Your exact impedance will move that way across the Smith chart as you add transmission line. Because you're not changing the radius of your dot to the center, the standing wave ratio is not changing. All you're really changing is the phase angle, how much inductance or capacitance or whatever. Now let's take a ridiculous example. Let me drop. I don't have the exact numbers, but let's assume now that my load is a 25-ohm resistor with no reactance. So that's a certain point toward the 9 o'clock position. It's a third of the way, roughly, toward the 9 o'clock position is a 25-ohm resistor. And that represents a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. As I add transmission line, that dot is now going to swing with my compass in a clockwise manner. And by the time I add an eighth wavelength of line, the dot will be toward the 12 o'clock position. As I swing it a little bit further, as I add more transmission line, it'll eventually be toward the 3 o'clock position on the Smith chart. And in all those positions, it's still a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. But toward the 12 o'clock position, when I've added a quarter wavelength of line, toward the 3 o'clock position, when I've added a quarter wavelength of line of this example, my 25-ohm resistor has just become a 100-ohm resistor. I've added a quarter wavelength of line, and 25 ohms, 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, now looks like a 100-ohm resistor. It's still a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. You take the ratio to 50 ohms, in one case it's 2-to-1 lower, in the other case it's 2-to-1 higher. Right there, you're starting to see a little bit of the so-called impedance inversion phenomena of a quarter wavelength of line. If you take it to the ridiculous example, a quarter wavelength of line you might use as a stub. Let me drop. The guys who use transmission line terminology a lot call it impedance inversion. If I've got a quarter wavelength of line, let's say, for instance, a stub, which I'm going to use with a T-connector somewhere along my transmission line as an impedance-matching device. So I've got this length of coax cable coming out the third connector of my T-connector. The straight-through connector is my input and output coax cable. And off to one side, I've got the stub. if I put a short circuit at the end of the stub, the short circuit at one end, a quarter wavelength away, will be an open circuit infinity. Or correspondingly, if I put an open circuit at the output end of the stub, the end that's connected to the T connector, will see a short circuit. So short on one end becomes an open on the other end, and vice versa. That's one way of looking at what they call impedance inversion. If I did put the open circuit at one end, where it becomes a short circuit at the T connector, that would be a beautiful way of stopping that particular frequency. In other words, I've got a system that's listening to 146 megacycles. There's a mysterious signal that's giving me a lot of grief coming from a local broadcast transmitter at 100 megahertz. So if I make the stub a quarter wavelength long at 100 megs, and I put an open circuit at the far end of the stub, the open circuit will represent a short circuit at the T connector at 100 megacycles only. So therefore, that simple stub I just described will give you a beautiful notch. If you did it correctly, you can probably get a 25 decibel notch at 100 megacycles, and the signal at 146 megacycles will come through with maybe 2/10 of a dB of insertion loss because you've added the stub. And I've now put the stub in a
repeater. Timeout.
I've used the stub in a very simple manner. If I was smart enough to choose the right number of wavelengths of stub, it's going to be multiples of a quarter wave. I can now I can choose a magic length of coax cable of the stub with a variable capacitor at the end so I can tune the thing. I can now fix it in such a way that I make a perfect short circuit at the 100 megacycle, the signal I want to notch, and a perfect open circuit of the stub at 146 megs that I want to listen to. So as you can see, a simple device like that can be a very handy way of rejecting an extremely strong signal. Correspondingly, if my antenna had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio of some particular crazy phase angle, in other words, a certain dot on the Smith chart, that's not toward 9 o'clock or not toward 3 o'clock, it's somewhere in between. So it's got reactance, resistance. It's a complex impedance with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. If I choose the magic position, a short distance away from the antenna, install my T connector, and install my carefully engineered stub of just the right length, with or without a variable capacitor at the end. Let me drop it. As long as you know the real impedance of your antenna, there's various ways you can get that, with an antenna analyzer, with a known length of cable, and so on. Or really, with your antenna analyzer on top of the tower, because it's battery operated. If you really know the impedance of the antenna, and you can get that, you can then design a stub a short distance away from the antenna that will make the stub plus antenna combination become a perfect 50 ohm resistor at your favorite frequency of operation. So it's a very useful device. Now let's go back to directional couplers. Let me drop. This is an area that is very poorly covered in all of the schools that I know of. It's slightly covered in some of the better books, but not in a way that's easy to understand. And the fact that the directional coupler almost sounds like it violates reciprocity. How could it respond to a signal that goes in one direction down the transmission line and not respond to a signal in the other direction? And there's a way I could explain that, but it would get a little bit lengthy right now. However, take my word for it. A well-designed directional coupler, and there's a pair of them inside of almost every standing wave ratio bridge. You want to measure the amount of forward-going signal from the transmitter, the amount of reverse coming signal from the reflection of the antenna, and the ratio between those two, with the right calculation, is standing wave ratio. And the standing wave ratio has to be measured in a voltage manner in order for the mathematics to come out right. And many of these directional sensing devices, like your Bird wattmeter, for instance, is a directional power meter. You'd be able to measure with it. With your directional power meter, like a Bird wattmeter, you'd be able to measure that 100 watts is going forward and 25 watts is coming back. And so, that's a 4-to-1 ratio, but you got to take the square root of that. That example, I think, would be a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio because it's the square root of the power ratio that becomes standing wave ratio. You got to convert it back into voltage. Now, so that bird watt meter, if it's working correctly, is measuring the forward watts of 100 watts in my example, and the fact that 25 watts is coming back, when you reverse the slug on the bird watt meter, you'll measure the 25 watts coming back, and if it's working correctly, it should see none of the forward 100 watts during that second measurement. Correspondingly, when you're making the first measurement, 100 watts forward, it should see none of the 25 watts coming back. If it has high directivity of the slug, the slug is properly tuned and calibrated, it's measuring true power, and it's only measuring the desired power of that direction. It's rejecting all other power flowing in all the directions, so to speak. Let me drop. Question for that subject. Yeah, I'm going to finish these couple of statements first before I take questions. Now, if during the time you are measuring the reverse power of 25 watts, in my example, if any of the 100 watts forward, like even 1 watt of it, gets mixed into that directional coupler measurement, that the bird watt meter, the slug, is not properly calibrated, doesn't have high directivity. If any of the forward measured power is being seen by that slug during that measurement, and there's ways you can confirm that, then when you change the position of the directional power meter along the transmission line, now let me give you an example of that. I've added a little bit of extra line length between the directional power meter and the rest of the transmission line. I've added an extra chunk of line in there. So now that the length of line going to the antenna got longer, as such, the signal from the transmitter got up to the antenna a little bit later and had a longer length of line to go through. The signal reflected from the antenna is still the exact same percentage and still the exact same phase angle at the antenna, but now that reflected signal is coming back down this longer line, and it's going to be doubly delayed. It's a phase shift. Delay in the standing wave, delay in RF energy, really is a new phase angle. Now, because the new phase angle of signal coming back to your power meter, which wants to measure 25 watts coming back, but it's got a little bit of the forward going power, the 1 watt in my example, is coming in there at the same time, that 1 watt of forward and the reflected power of 25 watts at certain line lengths or certain positions of the bird watt meter, those two signals are in phase, and you'll measure, instead of 25 watts coming back, you'll measure 26. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit here, just to give you an idea. And at a certain position, or
repeater, timeout.
At a brand new position of that directional power meter, or a brand new length of line, those two signals going forward and reverse, 1 watt of leakage signal, 25 watts coming back, will be out of phase, and I'll measure 24 watts. So I can measure either 24 or 26 in my example. Of course, I've got a machine there with a very small amount of leakage, only 1 watt out of 100, and therefore the error of 26 or 24 watts indicated when it really should be 25 coming back, it's a small error. When something is out of calibration and doesn't have high directivity, that error can become a hell of a lot larger. So that's one example now where you can see the mechanism by which I change the length of transmission line between my power directional power meter output in the antenna. I change the length of transmission line. It changes the relative phase angle of forward versus reverse signal. Therefore, your less than ideal directional power meter, your less than ideal dual directional coupler, your less than ideal standing wave ratio bridge will now measure a higher or lower standing wave ratio, will be the indicated apparent standing wave ratio, and because of that error, and you don't know that it's your instrumentation doing it, you'll think that there's a magic length of transmission line where you can make standing wave ratio disappear. There's a whole lot of people who believe that. Let me drop. There's a whole lot of people who believe that if you're going to measure forward power and reverse power and performance of your antenna system, that there's got to be a magical length of transmission line between that directional power meter, between your bird watt meter and the antenna. There's a whole lot of people who think that you only get the correct indication if there's an exact number of half wavelengths of transmission line, and that all other lengths of transmission line line are going to give you an error in the measurement. There's a lot of people who believe that. You read the owner's manual and your bird watt meter, and you'll see there's no such thing. They don't tell you there's a magic lens where it tells the truth and there are other lens where it doesn't tell the truth. But there's a lot of people who believe that. Let's see what Wes's question is along these lines. In 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2XJN, some additional information needed. You have a vector network analyzer. You set the frequency at 144 MHz. You want to have a stop nearby the antenna. And stop plus the antenna will then match the impedance. But normally what you do is you take your transmission line, at the end you put your short, you open your load, and then you actually eliminate that coax. Fine. But now you need some coax, which you don't know what coax. And then you need to have that dipole, which that antenna that you don't know what is the impedance yet, and now you need to tune it. So kind of lost in the middle of it. Attention.
In every well-made modern-day network analog of the Hewlett-Packard like design, and Rohde & Schwarz and Ritsu and a whole lot of other people make very fine vector network analyzers. You normally take a length of transmission line, that's your test cable, coming out of the J1 port, and then you go through a calibration procedure if you're doing a one-port measurement, like standing wave ratio, where you do put a short, an open, and a good, a known good dummy load during the calibration procedure. And now you are electronically removing not only the length of line of that transmission line, but all of its idiosyncrasies. You may have a connector on each end that's less than ideal in the way it's installed, or it's a less than ideal connector itself, where the connector itself has some standing wave ratio. And there may be a pinch in the middle of the cable because somebody dropped a hammer on it a day ago and you didn't know that. There's a pinch in the middle of the cable. When you go through that calibration procedure of the vector network analyzer, essentially all of those idiosyncrasies of the cable are removed. And now you have referenced the system to the end of that test cable. Let me drop it. And now when you put your unknown thing there, amplifier, dummy load, antenna, whatever, you're now measuring the input impedance of that device and displaying it in one of a number of different displays on that vector network analyzer. That's the ideal world. There's a catch. You could, in theory, take a 100-foot-long transmission line that goes from your shack to the top of the tower, and your antenna is on the end of that transmission line. And in theory, you can now put, you have a person standing at the top of the tower with a handy-talkie in his hand, and you're giving him commands from the shack, and you tell him, okay, I'm going through the calibration procedure of my vector network analyzer right now, and if I tell you to put on the short, and I go through the short procedure, put on the open, you go through that procedure, put on the dummy load, you press the appropriate button on the vector network analyzer, you've now calibrated the whole length of transmission line for that particular measurement from the shack, and now the loss of the line, the bumps in the line, the imperfections in the line, and everything else, in theory, by the 12-point calibration procedure, is now taken out, and now in the shack, at that calibration frequency, you can now measure the exact impedance of your antenna. There's a catch here. Let me drop it. And that is the calibration procedure. Usually you select a low and a high frequency over which you want to do the calibration. And I might, in my example, say, I want to calibrate this transmission line system between 100 and 200 megahertz. And I go through that calibration procedure. And what the machine is doing during the calibration procedure, while the short, the open, and the dummy load is there, it is hopping a specific number of frequencies. It may hop every 2 megacycles, every 3 megacycles, every 1 megacycle, depending on how you set up the calibration procedure. The problem with a very long transmission line is that in between those steps of 1, 2, or 3 megacycles of my example, all hell may break loose. In other words, your individual bumps of your transmission line, because it is so long, could now give you a significant difference between the 102 and the 103 megacycle and the 104 megacycle and the 105 megacycle measurement. So at those exact frequencies, it's going to give you the right answer. In between, the machine connects the dots with a straight line, so to speak, and so when you've got a very long transmission line, you got to be kind of careful. You might get a slightly erroneous answer. But this is a fine detail. But once you know the exact impedance of your antenna, there are multiple ways you can do that. You now can calculate exactly where the stub should be placed and exactly how long the stub should be in order to make that system perfect, at least at that one frequency. And as long as the location of the stub is close enough to the antenna, then the bandwidth over which, let me drop, the bandwidth of which you're getting a good impedance match could be quite good. The stub might give you a beautiful match between 144 megs and 148 megs. As you move that stub closer and closer to the shack, a larger and larger number of wavelengths between the stub and the antenna. Now you start getting a little bit more hairy on what happens. In other words, you may do the calculation at 146.85 megacycles, but because you've got so many wavelengths between the stub and the antenna, you now might not have anywhere near as good a match at 144 megacycles, the CW portion of the band, so to speak. So you'd like to make the stub for that correcting procedure as close to the antenna as possible, because the wavelengths in between start multiplying as a function of frequency. In other words, you'd like the number of wavelengths between stub and antenna to stay the same as you switch frequency. Well, if you've got a near zero length of that line between the two, that is obeyed. As you start making many wavelengths of coax cable between the stub and the antenna, now as you switch frequency, the number of wavelengths is going up or down, and therefore the stub is no longer the proper caliber, no longer the proper compensation, if you know what I mean. I wonder if this is starting to make a little bit more sense. The original guy who asked this question was John, and you're into an area here, John, where a lot of people have got a lot of misunderstanding. Let me drop. I started off as a person who didn't like vector network analyzers, because the vector network analyzers in the early days of Hewlett-Packard were very cumbersome to use. You had a whole lot of extra hardware, a whole lot of fancy plug-in modules to get a Smith chart display versus an XY display. The calibration procedure was very lengthy, and they were a pain in the neck, and they gave a very slow answer. You take a modern-day vector network analyzer, which is so well computer-controlled, the calibration procedure is so simple, it becomes so user-friendly, and the answer is so fast, and in real time, you could be tuning an antenna by holding tuning tools near the elements to find out which element wants to be longer or shorter as you hold your straight capacitance piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick. You hold it near the driven element, near the reflector, near the director, and in real time, on your neck or analyzer with a Smith chart display, I do that with an XY plot. I use two separate displays. I use blue for gain and yellow for visual. And I keep making adjustments on the antenna so that the blue curve gets as high as possible, indicating high gain, and the yellow curve gets as low as possible, giving you the best standing wave ratio across that band of interest. Let me drop. And normally those two phenomena, standing wave ratio and gain, are slightly antagonistic. In other words, making one better will hurt the other and vice versa. Well, there are magic ways of tuning. When you can see it all happening with 30 sweeps per second on that screen, which means there's no flicker, the eye sees no flicker, you're watching that blue curve and the yellow curve in real time as you're wiggling your fingers on that wooden stick, making that stray capacitance go in and out, so to speak, and you're watching it happening in real time, and you find out, hey, there's a magic position. If I add a little bit of strain capacitance, the gain goes up and the standing wave ratio goes down simultaneously. Hey, that's a good position. Whatever I'm doing, let's do more of that. Put a small piece of copper tape on the antenna in that location, if you know what I mean. So when you're doing, as a ham radio tinkerer, and you're doing a real-time experiment, you'll be amazed how many things you discover that you never thought were possible. So if you ever get your hands on a good vector network analyzer, and I've been doing that now for 10 solid years, the bottom line was I started off hating those machines. And all of a sudden, because I had to use them, I had to use them in a very stringent requirement where in order to make a good antenna for a radio frequency identification interrogator or reader, in other words, you want this machine, a handheld machine with an antenna on the end of it that's got a small transmitter inside and a real good receiver inside and a fancy computer and a display, you want it to read the number that's built into that tag, and the tag is going to be somewhere between 1 foot and 20 feet in front of you. And so it sends out a signal, the tag receives that signal and sends back a response, somewhat like IFF, but it's a 96-bit response with all kinds of information coming back out of the tag. Well, that antenna on the handheld reader, in order to give you full performance, you want it to have no more than a 1.1 standing wave ratio across the frequency region of 902 to 928 megacycles inclusive. That's where the interrogator operates. The reader works over that frequency region. It's hopping every one of those megacycles in half megacycle steps in a pseudo-random manner so that it doesn't jam other things that are using that same frequency region, that license-free region. But you want the antenna to be no more than 1.1 standing wave ratio across every one of that 3% bandwidth. At the same time, it displays 6 decibels of gain. It's a very stringent requirement. You give that requirement to an ordinary antenna manufacturer, and he says, you're crazy, I can't build that. Let me drop it. But by this tinkering technique, I've been building those kind of antennas and filing patents on them for the last 10 years. And so, as you can tell, I've gone from being a vector network analyzer hater to a vector network analyzer lover. As long as you've got the right machine with the right calibration in the right laboratory, so to speak, boy, you can do magic with one of those, John. And once you get your hands on one of those with the attitude that I've got, you're going to say, I've got to have one of those. I don't care what it costs. With that test equipment you've got and that picture you've got on QSZ.com, if you don't already have a vector network analyzer, it's going to be just a matter of time before you. I think you do, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW, the TechNet. You got it, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. You know, there was a time where I thought I knew a lot about RF in my career. I have so much more to learn, and I look forward to filling in all those gaps that are created every moment that I do more and more. I only wish I had time and money to go back to school. If I'm ever laid off again, I might come sleep in your garage for a couple weeks. Maybe I'll learn a thing or two. Very good explanations. Some things I'm still a little foggy on, but that's okay. That's why we do these things. You've set a lot of really good seeds. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, that's a very old network analyzer, but that's about all I could afford to get started here. I used to have access to a lot of really nice equipment that was available to me, but, you know, as an employee, now I no longer have that, so I'm trying to build my own lab here, and unfortunately, yeah, that's about the level that I can do right now. Today, I'd love to upgrade, and maybe somebody else will really enjoy having this unit, the it's an 8711A. Unfortunately, no Smith chart. I really wish it had that. Although someday I would like to also, you know, try to get a handheld unit. It is nice to have something a little more portable, but we know the accuracy and the speed of those is also compromised, although I do think they're getting better all the time. Very good answers. Not sure I have any additional questions at the moment. If the discussion goes on, I surely will not complain, of course. So I don't know if I should put it in there. I think I understand group delay, but that also seems to be ringing in my mind as something that is fairly closely related to what we're talking about. Am I far off, or am I close to RIW KC2SHO?
One of the statements you made, John, is that if you had the time, you would take some more classes in order to learn RF. Believe it or not, I almost do not recommend that. The reason for that, it is my opinion, and everybody's going to agree with this one, that a large percentage of the electrical engineering schools do a less than mediocre job of teaching wireless engineering phenomena, wireless engineering technology. They do a less than mediocre job of teaching it in a way that gives you useful engineering information. The curriculum for most of those courses was set in roughly 1947, right after the Radiation Laboratory series of books from MIT came out. The MIT Radiation Laboratory did a tremendous amount of very good work, research, and development of techniques and philosophies and whatever, theory of operation. Let me drop. The Radiation Laboratory did a tremendous amount of research and development during World War II. And at the end of that, a series of about 30 books were published. It's called the Radiation Laboratory series of textbooks. And those books do a very good job of telling you what was available and what was the state of the art in roughly 1947 or so, 1948. McGraw-Hill published those books around that time. And so many of the courses that you take are using that series of books to some degree, not as much as I'd like, and going back to Maxwell's equations, which Maxwell's equations, everyone calls that the foundation of electronics. But that's a foundation that is so deep. By deep, I mean below the surface of the ground. Yes, it is a foundation, but we've gone so many steps beyond that in the way we use electrical engineering today in a modern laboratory, such that you talk to a guy who has been doing antenna research for the last few years, and he's published a couple of articles. He's maybe even applied for a couple of patents. He solved a couple of problems for his employer, for their particular customer. And so you ask him, how many times have you used Maxwell's equations during this development of the work you've done for the last 10 years? You ask that question, you'll be amazed at the answer you get. The answer is almost never. If he's writing a technical article and he wants the article to sound erudite, he'll throw in some Maxwell's equations somewhere in the article. But for the most part, he didn't use it. He, as an electrical engineer, as an antenna designer, has a whole bunch of rules of thumb that he has developed. And to be a good antenna designer, I think it's rare for a person to do that without at least 10 years of apprenticeship. Now, if it's a ham radio antenna you're building, you're building dipoles and Yagis and cubicle quads and ground plane antennas on multiple frequencies, and you're following ham radio articles, and you're doing tinkering, yes, you can learn a hell of a lot of what's going on in a much, much shorter period of time. But in order to do commercial work, the majority of people who are good at it, in antenna design and impedance matching to transmission lines and so on, they've had at least 10 or more, maybe even 20 years of apprenticeship, because there's a lot more to RF than first meets the eye. And as I said, by doing tinkering in your own laboratory, talking to people, and you want to go to the really progressive people, you go to the guys who are doing it as a passion, the guys that are above 1,000 megacycles on ham radio. It's only a few percentage of the ham radio population that's doing that. Of the 26 kinds of ham radio, let me drop. Many of those microwave people, they live and breathe the stuff. They talk to each other on a daily basis by way of the microwave reflector, WA1MPA. You Google the word, you give the address of www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org. That group of people, led by Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MPA, they write to each other multiple emails back and forth on this listserv on a daily basis. And these are the guys that in their backyard are doing tinkering at microwave frequencies. And they're learning the art and science of how microwave antennas and transmission lines really work. And because of the scaling factor, if you can solve a problem at 10 gigahertz or 24 gigahertz, so to speak, if you can solve a problem there, to scale the problem down to 3.5 megacycles to 80 meter band is easy as all hell, if you know what I mean. Once you understand the theory of operation, scaling it to a lower frequency is very easy. And these guys are using good vector network analyzers, power meters, transmitters of their own design, receivers of their own design, and developing these techniques to figure out what's going on. So I almost think that that is a much faster learning technique than good schools. Now, there's a catch to that. There are a couple of schools that do a very good job. I hear tell that Stanford Research does a good job. University of Virginia does a very